Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a ton of books that have come out this week, and maybe one that comes out later, I guess.
See if you can spot it, astute listeners.
But let's kick it off with a couple of big ones right off the top. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 150 from IDW, written by Sophie Campbell, art by Vincenzo Federici. Now, as we've talked about here on the podcast before, this is the end of the current era of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles before we kick into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Alpha, that will serve as both a coda to this era and a kickoff to the Jason Aaron era that's going to be taking up the next couple of months. Lots of hype on that, but I also think it's worth checking in with this before this ends here. So what do you think? We've, full disclosure, for the most part, I think only been reading this Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on and off, except for the last three issues or so. How do you think that all said, it wrapped up?
Great number one. Great first issue to pick up to get into the series.
Yeah. Just walk right in. Yeah.
I will say, this is not at all slagging off the writing. The art is great in this. There are some great action sequences as we follow. Which turtle, Pete?
Donatello.
Okay.
There's only four to keep track of, bro.
No, Too many. They got to whittle down the turtles. Donatello is jumping through time. They do a little bit of a Turtles in Time, Turtles Back in Time. Was that the name of the movie?
No, Turtles in Time.
Turtles in Time. So they do a little thing jumping through the different eras, of course, to pay tribute to it as they go, as they fight this gigantic whale creature that wants to eat all of reality. I think the shriveled shark.
I think it's a shark, isn't it?
I don't know.
Armagon?
I can't.
It's a creature. Yeah,
definitely has teeth. They're not fighting baleen, Alex.
Donatello gets strained at the end like kelp. It's gross. I don't know. I like the look of that. I thought that was a very good. And there's a lot in here, just coloring wise and shading wise and inking wise in particular, that I feel like really harkens back to classic. Classic Turtles. So from a visual perspective, as a longtime Turtles fan, I really appreciated that.
Well, and let me say, I was saying, like, it is crazy to pick this up as a first issue, but I actually really liked this issue. It's really sweet. The focus on Donatello, who does machines, so obviously he's the best, smartest.
Come on, dude.
So, right?
He's the most cartoon. Raphael is a party dude, I believe.
No,
I think that's an
he's cool but rude, you fucking assholes.
Oh, okay, Michelangelo is a party.
It's
dude?
Interesting, Pete. You were mad about me making the TV comparison, and then you immediately dropped into it. So, what's happening. Yeah. But I did think this was really nice. And shout out to the fact that let's never forget that Splinter is not a human that turned into a rat. Splinter is a rat that learned karate and then was turned into a giant rat. Shouts to that. They paid homage to that in a way where I was like, it's crazy you're owning this, because that's a weird way to make a master.
Yeah. Well, first off, I mean, just the panel of Donatello putting his head to Splinter's head got me in the feels. Like, there's moments in this that really kind of choked me up in this. Just really just great kind of emotion things that really pay off well. Amazing action. Oh, my God. I really loved a lot of it. And, you know, I feel like Donatello is a great kind of thing to focus on. It got a little, I wanted to love all of it, but the one part where the kind of future mean Donatello was like, it's just drawings, got a little meta for me. And I was a little like, eh. But overall, it was kind of a fun romp through time because it did. It visited the old school Eastman and Laird. It visited the kind of cartoon era. It was nice to kind of go through that, especially because we're getting a kind of changing the guard. So it's nice mm-hmm. to kind of have an homage to that. But yeah, art's unbelievable. This is a great book. I'm super excited for what's coming next. But this was just really fantastic.
I love the creative swings. I liked actually the drawing part. I thought it was a nice sort of way to weave in a meta textual thing. And this era is ending, so I'm excited to see the reset as well.
Spectrograph, number one from Distillery, written by James Tynion IV, art by Christian Ward. This is about... I'm going to get into spoilers here because it's hard to describe this premise without doing it, but this is a mother who semi-accidentally from stress leaves her child at home while she's going to sell a house. Turns out the house, though, is a machine that creates ghosts, and she is ultimately trapped inside. I think that's all there in the blurb, so I feel fair talking about that. I said this on the live show. Story. I will say this again. This is the most stressful comic book I have read in such a long time. I was so upset reading this, and I say this, mind you, all complimentarily and positively here, but it was so upsetting. I had nightmares about it last night after I read this book.
Wait, was it the nightmare where like you leave your kids in your home and you just go to kind of like shop for homes in a different
area? No, Alex
area?
Buys a house that is a ghost machine.
Yeah, it's the thing that I had a nightmare about is writing a cool comic book that everybody did. No, I had a dream the way that I don't know exactly who it comes from because James Tynion is obviously a meticulous writer. We've interviewed Christian Ward as well on the show a lot, and he thinks a lot about the layouts of the art. The way that they lay out first slowly reveal that she's left her son behind. And then the way that that starts consuming and taking over the action and the paneling is alarming, is the way that I'd put it. And it ultimately led to this dream that I had where I left my son behind while we were going on like a trip. We were on a subway and I looked out and he was just sort of, he's almost 10, but he's not a baby, but he was like wandering around outside as the train pulled out. And I woke up out of that dream like, oh, goddamn that comic. And that's how I kind of woke up.
Well, I hope you talked to your son about that dream and talked about how it's a real concern to you and that you guys should come up with a plan.
We run drills. Like, we don't run – drills is probably the wrong word. But we definitely, like – I think about it all the time on the subway anyway. And I constantly, like, what do you do if you go off the subway but I'm on the subway? What do you do if I go off the subway but you're on the subway? We talk about it all the time.
Wow, that's smart. Great. I was on an air train to JFK, and that happened to a family where the little girl got on the air train before, and the family was like, no. And it was very intense.
Wait, you rode with the little girl?
I was on the train already, and I was the little girl looked around and was like, you could see her being like, ha-ha, and then be like, oh no. I messed up. And they were like, 15 people there to help, and like it was actually, I'm sure it was fine.
But they needed 16. They needed you to make sure that everything happened all right. And it's because you put down
your sunglasses because you were hungover, and you're like,
turned your hat backwards, and we're like, not my problem, and hopped on your skateboard.
Good luck, little lady. I said, back to my business.
Anyway, irregardless,
we got to hear how that story ends, though, because you can't just bring this up randomly. You know
well, that's
I mean?
The plot of, I believe, Godzilla 2014 that happens at some point in there.
But let's talk about this actual comic book. Let me just credit this comic book by inspiring horror in the part of the comic that was real, that is based in reality, which I think that's what I loved about this. Like, the horror starts before we even get to the ghostly premise, and that is so smart. Like, James Tynion IV is just, I've said this probably too many times, is on a heater. He's on a banger right now. He just can't miss.
Just crank it out. Another hits. One.
Crank it out. Hits. I love the horror part of this, the real life stuff, and then the house and all of that is so intriguing, and we're just beginning to unfold the mystery of that. Another fantastic book.
I mean, as much as I love JT4, and I do, the art on this is just unfucking believable. I mean, this is epic. The big splash pages, the kind of like little kind of like the action little splash panels. Pages. Yeah, like there's just so much happening here visually. It is so fucking impressive. The way it switches back between like a happy bright tone and super dark. And then that flashlight sequence where the flashlight just comes out and then just kind of like overtakes all the panels. Just so artistically impressive and thought out and put together in such an amazing way. I just couldn't get over how much I enjoyed flipping through this.
You're in the splash zone, Pete. You're in the splash zone.
I get in the zone. You know what I mean?
And I'll also say, before we move on to the next title, Distillery also is kind of putting out nothing but bangers at the same time. It's really impressive how hard they've come out of the gate with this stuff. That's really hard to do as a new publisher. And granted, you've got great creative teams behind it, but this is not like JT4 and Christian Ward being like, yeah, this is a secondary publisher. This is them putting it all there on the page. And it's
put in the work.
It's great.
Yeah.
The love page.
Just get ready for nightmares. Ultimate Spider-Man #4 from Marvel, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by David Mesita. In this issue, because you demanded Mary Jane and Peter Parker got a double date with Harry Osborn and Gwen
Stacy. And his girlfriend,
Gwen Stacy. His wife.
Oh, sorry, Gwen wife. Stacy. Yes, wife.
Yeah.
A wife is a girlfriend you've stayed with for a long time.
Girlfriend Plus. It's like Apple Plus.
It's like you got to pay for it, but you have a different title.
Listen, when I think about the Ultimate Spider-Man, I think about like
ultimate dating.
I want to see like what are they eating? What are they talking about? Do they go to the bathroom to fix up their makeup? Like that is.
I did feel bad about MJ and Gwen Stacy during the meal because they kept getting, in awkward kind of positions. They were like, with their mouth open and stuff. And I was like, what are we doing with this?
Eating. That's just what eating is.
It's just like, I don't know. It was kind of a weird.
Where do you put the food?
You can do it differently. It was just a little bit weird. And I was like, are we trying to sexualize here? Like, what are we doing with this? Because it's a little
is chaotic.
Just because a woman's mouth is open, it's not inherently sexual.
I know, but for a couple panels, it's a weird kind of thing that keeps happening. And I'm just like, what are we doing here? We can make better choices is all I'm
saying.
Have
you ever eaten a meal with a person, man or woman?
Yeah, and if you were taking pictures of them the whole time, you delete the weird ones when their mouth is like, you know what I mean? So anyways.
Sorry, are you taking pictures of the people you're eating dinner with?
Always.
And you're deleting the weird ones?
Yep. Yeah, that's how I roll.
A lot of reveals here.
Yeah, I just think that this was just kind of like, what if Spider-Man and MJ how awkward and crazy would that be? Look at all the layers of history.
I like this book. I understand what you're saying, and I know I was joking about it. Like, I do think this is a good book. It is surprising to me that this is Ultimate Spider-Man, because this is go ahead, Justin.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I actually think this is an ultimate expression of Spider-Man. It's taking... I said this on the live show, like, it's taking the Spider-Man essential premise, which we've seen reinvented like so many times, and actually bringing like some fresh character perspective to it and mixing up the situation in a way that felt more character-based, relationship-based. I like putting Harry, Peter, Mary Jane, Gwen together because like there's inherent drama there. There's no way for this not to be dramatic if you're a Spider-Man fan. And that's so smart. And to put Gwen in sort of the most powerful, confident position is also a nice upsetting of what you would expect. Gwen is someone who is just the eternal victim. Like she's someone who, you know, if you reread the comics leading up to it, yes, maybe not. But ever since then, it's been Gwen is the character that dies and is only there to affect Peter Parker. Here, it's a totally different relationship. I just thought this was such a nice dramatic issue that mostly featured people eating food.
Yeah, I mean, it was Yeah, I just felt like they were, the drama of it is what the shock value of, like, could you imagine?
But that wasn't, see, it didn't dwell on it.
It wasn't shock value.
It was a reveal. It's a character building and then a story. Issue.
I do, yeah. I understand that you don't have to like it, Pete, but your commentary.
I'm team
here,
PJ, all right?
PJ?
Sorry, PJ?
Yeah, Pete and Mary Jane.
PJ's the choice you're making there?
Yep.
Nobody
calls like PJ, like, Peter,
like
Jane?
Like they hang out in their PJs.
Oh, okay. Okay. I don't even say what I wanted to say. Instead, I'll offer up a little bit of information that I thought really enriched the experience of reading this, and I presume will enrich the experience of reading other Ultimate titles. Something that I didn't realize that was picked up on.
Oh, yes, I love this.
Cool, that I thought was very bleeding cool, honestly. These titles apparently are happening in real time. If you notice, each issue of Ultimate Spider-Man has a date identifier for the month that it's revealed in, it's released in, excuse me. And either a month of time takes place over the course of the issue, or time has passed between issues, as it is here, where we left off with Harry and Peter on a rooftop being like, well, now we know that we're the Green Goblin and Spider-Man, should we have a drink? This is picking up a month later in April when this has been going on. They know it. They've already had those conversations, all of those things. Same thing is happening in Ultimate Black Panther and Ultimate X-Men a little more subtly. But this is all leading up to something that we kind of knew anyway, that we talked about, that there's a ticking time bomb of 2 years from now, the Maker is going to be released from the city they trapped him in. So they basically have to repair the world and figure out how to be heroes before that happens. Otherwise, he's going to wreck shit again.
I think that's such a smart ticking clock that is so, so subtle, but present. At the same time, now that we know about it.
You love a ticking clock, and you also like it when you get on the bottom of the panels, like how much time is left. You love the countdown clock.
This is like Spawn. This is like Ultimate Spawn.
Yes.
Yes. Every comic should have a ticking clock, and every moment. We should have a countdown on this podcast right now.
That's called life. Batman Dark Age number 2 from DC Comics, written by Mark Russell, art by
Mike Allred.
Thank you. This is spinning off of Superman Space Age, and we are following Batman as he is not exactly a teen, maybe early 20s, and he is in prison, eventually getting out of prison and figuring out himself as Batman and getting the suit. So it's a new origin story. Great. Love Mark Russell in his serious mode. Love Mike Allred's art. I'm going to stop saying that.
Yeah, it's one of the more easy names to pronounce.
Yeah, it's all red.
It's literally just all
two
red.
Words put together.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I agree with you. This is just, well, first, it's worth it for the art alone. I mean, Mike Allred's art is just glorious. And, you know, we've seen Batman origin story told so many fucking times. So the fact that I wasn't immediately bored with this says a lot about the art and the storytelling. I think this was really kind of cool. And I was impressed at how much I was eating this up and not kind of chopping it down. And I love the Ra's al Ghul stuff and the kind of the talking about playing chess. It's really about who Batman is and how much he kind of thinks about things. So I was really very happy with this when I didn't think I would be.
I actually found this to be very different from a lot of the sort of Batman look back origin stuff. It feels like, especially Mike Allred's art helps to sort of out of the classic, like, let's look at Batman finding himself. But Mark Russell's writing also, it's like sort of approximating Batman as halfway between Captain America and Punisher. And that's why I thought the sort of war stuff here really hit that. It felt like it was like sort of the secret version of Captain America and the less let's kill everybody version of Punisher. And finding a middle, more Batman-esque ground here that made this really stand out as a very original take on a Batman Begins type story.
Yeah.
Now let's turn to an advance review. Spoiler, this is the one we were hinting at the top of the show. Grommets, number 1, out May 29th from Image Comics, written by Rick Remender and Brian Posehn, art by Brett Parson and Marina Denisio. This is an interesting one. It's set back in the day with a kid. He gets to school. He befriends another skater kid and heads to the skate park. That's pretty much the whole thing. This is not what I would expect at all from an Image Comics book in particular.
And from either of these creators, I would
Yes, argue. Because it's very much like the art. I don't think it's the same artist, but it's very much on the mode of the scumbag. Like, it's very familiar to that. It's very like
I'm a younger, more fun version of scumbag.
Right, but it feels more like a Richard Linklater movie than anything.
Yes.
And it's not... The reason I said it doesn't feel very Image Comics is it's not very premise driven. Maybe it is. I don't know where it's going necessarily, but this issue is very much just like character stuff and feeling and the vibe of the era. And that's pretty much it.
Well, it feels very memoir. Yeah. And something that we haven't really seen from Rick Remender a ton, or not anything that's nakedly memoir-y without having a premise underneath. And that's why this is all like hypothesizing, but this feels like Remender and Brian Posehn were like, hey, we have a similar background. Mm-hmm. Let's write a comic that approximates that. And this is it. And it's exciting it's a great comic. The art's great. It's also exciting because we may have a Remender comic where it doesn't go horribly wrong for the protagonist.
It seems like it's...
Because it's memoir, maybe. Yeah. And it goes wrong a little bit at the end of the issue, but maybe not at the end of the series. So shouts to that.
Yeah. I, as a kid who grew up in the 90s and tried to skateboard and fell all the time, I really felt very seen in this comic. Mm-hmm. They really nailed the nostalgia, the tone of the time, the popularity of like Santa Cruz and Vision and those kinds of things. Like, really was just a perfect, like the outfits, everything. It really did such a cool, the use of rad and stuff like that was really kind of, I think, really spot on and well done. I love this kind of look back at this time. And I was really impressed. And it doesn't feel like a Remender book, which is very impressive, sometimes you kind of like, I know what this is going to be, but I was very pleasantly surprised at what we got in this. And my argument here is that this is very Image, where I feel like Image does a great job of like, this is what you think you're getting, or this is what's popular, and we're trying different stuff ahead of the curve and are kind of always trying to push the envelope artistically and do different things. So I feel like this does a great job.
Brian Posehn is from Sacramento, where this comic is set. Mm-hmm. Rick Remender, it seems like he's from Portland.
And Brian Posehn's birth name is Grommets.
A lot of clues.
Daredevil number 8 from Marvel, written by Saladin Ahmed and Ascenti DG Chichester, Elsa Sinderson and Erica Schultz, art by Tommaso Bianchi, Stefano Raphael, Ken Lashley, Eric Koda, and Jan Basaldúa. This is not just an issue of the ongoing Daredevil series. It is also a celebration of 60 years
of
Daredevil moping his way around the place.
How dare you go after yourself with that? Don't bring that negative shit. This is a celebration.
We're
finally, we can celebrate Foggy just bumbling around an office room.
Hey,
we get a bunch of different stories of Matt Murdock, of Elektra, of other characters in his orbit. Pete, you seem pretty high on this one, so take it away.
Yes, I am. I just love this. I thought this was such a great celebration. I'm a sucker for stuff like this, especially stuff done well like this. What a great collection of all the different Daredevils that we've kind of seen lately in such a cool way. Also, all the Daredevil covers over the years was just such a cool thing. The cartoons in the back were glorious. I mean, this is a total package deal here. You're really getting a lot of bang for your buck. I just think this is such a great celebration of Daredevil and what's going on right now and where they are. So I was just super impressed with the collaboration on this.
She also Daredevil Woman Without Fear in this. Like, I really think this is a great Elektra issue from the yes. front story and the standalone story we got from her. Very good. Some of the other stuff, I was like, it's crazy that Daredevil is just like changes his clothes all the time and is like, I'm different. which yeah. is, that these stories are
can,
very.
Can I throw
much
something out at you? I don't know if I totally believe this, but at least in this issue, I was like, I like Elektra as Daredevil better than Batman.
Yes, that's literally what I'm saying. Yeah. Yes. Especially in the front story where Daredevil's sort of like, I don't like this. I just got my memory back. I'm scared to talk to Foggy. I'm like, why are you running away from the story so hard? Mm-hmm. While Elektra is just like, I'm Daredevil. I'm good at this. I have stuff to say. Give me that.
Well, and even Matt says that at one point in the issue. He's like, I don't know, I think Elektra is better Daredevil than me, and she kind of is. Yep. It's a really good costume redesign as well. Yeah. Like, there's no reason it should work, but I think this is up there with Bucky taking over Captain America, with Dick Grayson taking over Batman, where you have a character who's like, I feel kind of weird about this, but I'm going to do this anyway. And I love that mood. I love that tension there. And it works so well. I'm very stoked.
Well, and let me pitch this.
Extra Daredevil title.
Put Matt Murdock as the man in the chair. He put him behind the scenes, helping Elektra do what, as he recovers from all the things that have happened to him, because the way that the story is going where he's like, I'm a priest. And then he like begrudgingly goes and fights crime. I'm like, that's not quite hitting, I feel like. Mm-hmm. And if you just back him off and have them combine, especially when you bring their love story into it, that's fun. Mm-hmm. I love that idea.
Yeah. Great Bullseye in here.
Yes.
I would say.
I've said this before. I'm over Bullseye.
I know.
He's good at throwing stuff. Fine. He's not scary.
Bullseye wearing
he's not
a jacket,
that scary.
Though?
Very Dude, fun he visual. Is scary. Someone who can be deadly with their aim and kind of take people out.
I'm sorry. I love
it. Can he throw things harder than a regular person? I don't think so.
Dude, Aaron you Cooter.
Why is his dead thing so deadly?
Aaron Cooter putting Bullseye in a TED Talk situation where he's wearing a jacket and one of those mics around his head. Very funny.
I will say him pivoting to like men's rights advocate, like that makes sense. I'm here for that. The idea that everyone's like, oh no, Bullseye's here, where he just throws a pencil as hard as he can. He's a regular person.
Yeah, but that's the thing. They talk about like, you know, it's talking about how fragile people are and how easily you can hurt somebody with something like a pencil or choking on a peanut in the movie, you know.
Yeah, but hold on though. His power set is has great aim. If you threw a pencil at me across the room, it would not kill me. And you're telling me that
Bullseye. Pete's not Bullseye.
But if you hit me in the eye, it would hurt. It wouldn't kill me. You're going to hit me in the heart with a pencil?
Bullseye, if you're Colin Farrell?
He's not good. Wow. Shouts. He has no super strength. He's just good at throwing stuff.
Yes.
He's Gambit. He's like a shitty Gambit. And like, get out of here with that.
No.
I'm not scared of Bullseye. And why are we, as comic book fans, giving Bullseye respect that he does not deserve? Get out of here.
He deserves it. He deserves it.
When you die by Bullseye somehow,
yeah, man,
I'm gonna be like, serves you right. Yeah. Dick Tracy.
Wait, before we move on, also,
you're gonna see a paper airplane fly by and it's gonna cut open your neck and you're gonna be like, oh, I get it now.
Why? Why would it do that?
Because it'll have like a little razor blade on it. It'll cut you right.
That's not how his powers work. He doesn't make little tricks. He's not Forge for airplanes. He throws stuff at a regular pace. He throws stuff regular. He just can hit it.
Yeah,
so he better have
a
very sharp.
Dude, you don't have glasses.
He doesn't throw faster.
He can put like a needle right through your eye, bro.
He can throw a needle better than you.
Have you ever snapped a dime or like a penny or something?
Yeah, come on, done that thing.
You're telling me he's better at snapping a dime?
Yeah,
that's his kill.
Shoot a popper.
Okay, if that's I want to see that in the comic.
Yeah,
if he's like,
I'm sure it's already happened.
Totally.
I just think we've overpowered Bullseye to the point that everyone sees him and they're like, oh no, he's here. And I'm like, he sucks. He's like a shitty Green Arrow.
He is not the stilt man of villains, dude. He's better than that.
He definitely is. It's just we boosted him up for no reason. Get out of here with that.
No.
I want to say the reveal at the end of this issue of the villain behind the villain, suspect, not sure what we're doing here when the rest of the Marvel Universe has elevated this character as a vague hero. What are we doing?
I think we're just returning to status quo is what's happening. Just
sort it out, though. Make sense.
It's an anniversary, dude. Come on, man.
Fine. Just go with it.
Slight spoiler. I'll say what it is. Why is the Kingpin helping the X-Men? And then he's like, oh, no, he hates Daredevil still? It's like, what? What are we doing here?
Yeah, but he's also running the Heat, which is all cops. I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on. Dick Tracy, number one from Mad Cave Studios, written by Alex Segura and Michael Morrissey, art by Geraldo Borges. This is a not exactly modern reinvention of Dick Tracy, but it's certainly taking him into the modern era of comics. What did you fellows think about this one?
Well, first I want to start off, it's too bad we're not going to have him on to talk about this comic because, you know, if we Alex Segura was coming up anytime soon, it would be fun to be able to talk to him about this.
Oh, he's going to be on next week's live show, Pete.
Oh, wow. Huge reveal.
What a fun plug for that. Yeah,
Scene. Perfectly done, guys. Let's do this from the podcast. That was a really great bit of play acting.
Okay, great.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for Dick Tracy stuff. I think it's just kind of classic fun times. I think they did a great job with the action in the story in this. I love the art. I just feel like this feels like a fun Dick Tracy story. So I think they did a good job.
Could I bring up my biggest problem with this issue? Ooh, Dick Tracy doesn't have a weird nose. Like, his nose is very normal. He usually has, like, a very angular nose. And that, I feel like, he's got an angular nose, and he's got a yellow coat, and that's, like, what makes him.
He has the yellow coat.
His nose has been broken. Exactly. But his nose is like normal. And I was like, that's a different guy. That is your
He's too good looking. Yeah. He's like a giant.
This guy hasn't been punched in the face enough.
Fuck that guy too hard, you know?
What?
Yeah. That Alex's take is like, this Dick Tracy's too fuckable.
Yeah.
Man. Put that on the cover.
Dick Tracy
guys.
Put my dick in that Tracy.
Oh.
Too far?
No, that's just right for a comic book review.
No,
that's
not.
Just right. That's right. No. That's the zone we as journalists want to be in.
Oh, man. I wish you would
I like
that
this
on
comic.
The cover. Mad Cave Studios, we give you permission to use that.
Yeah. Definitely something we should say. We should give permission after every review, like permission granted for using the nonsense we just said. I like this comic.
I try to put our
You're
going
to have to apologize to Alex Segura when he comes on the show next week because what you're saying
he
is ridiculous.
He will never listen to this. It's fine. I try to put together our reviews for the website. Like, I'm like, oh, I could just write them up. And I'm like, this is crazy. What are we even talking about here?
Yeah, you don't never transcribe this, please. Anyway. But let me say, I thought this comic was great. I really love the balance between Dick Tracy and Tess and the villains, because the villains of Dick Tracy, rightly so, are sort of a lot where a lot of the fun is. So great work there. Also, how crazy would it be if you're at a crime scene and some dude in a yellow coat shows up and is like, I'm in charge here. He's like, yo, you're a clown. Get out of here.
No, you'd be like, yo, go find Curious George. Get the fuck out of here.
That's right. I say that a lot.
I do think Geraldo Borges or Geraldo Borges is very much trying to go for a Frank Miller Sin City vibe here. And I'll tell you what, it's working. I think it's definitely hitting that very well. So good stuff.
And giving Tess a lot of juice here, I think, is great. Their partnership feels very strong. Mm-hmm.
Shout outs to the movie Juice.
Universal Monsters, Creature from the Black Lagoon Lives, number one, from Image Comics and Skybound, written by Dan Waters and Reb V, art by Matthew Roberts. I'll give a plug right up front. Later on today, if you're listening to this, like right at 9 a.m., I'm going to have an interview with Dan Waters that's going to be going out diving into this book. Great chat with him.
Definitely. Did you talk to him about this book, though?
I did indeed chat with him about this book versus the Dracula book by James Todd IV and Martin Simmons, which was kind of like a pretty straight adaptation of Dracula. This is a sequel to Creature from the Black Lagoon. It's picking up years later. It's following a journalist who is investigating a murder who gets, generously saying this, very confused about what's going on, where there's an actual monster killing people versus a metaphorical monster in a serial killer. So that's very much what they're playing with here. I really like this. I think the real standout is Matthew Roberts' art, particularly in the sequences that involve water here, I thought were very, very nice. What did you guys think?
I hope in that interview you told both Dan Waters and Ramvi that the real hero here is Matthew Roberts. You know what
well,
I mean?
Ramvi, first of all, was not in the interview. It was just Dan Waters. But yes, I did otherwise.
I think in all of our years as journalists, we've known that when you talk to the writer, definitely compliment the artist the whole time.
Yeah, the whole time. And vice versa. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. This is a lot of fun. It kind of reminded me of the Swamp Thing from back in the 80s a little bit, where you kind of have a main character kind of getting into a little bit of trouble.
Because of the swamp lagoon situation.
Right, but also because...
And the thing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, what I'm trying to get at here, before you guys keep interrupting me, is this idea that like someone gets into trouble and then maybe scared of the monster, but maybe the monster is the hero here. You know what I mean? So I'm excited for what's going to happen.
Totally agree. Good book. Let's talk about...
I also enjoyed this book. I feel like it, especially compared to the Dracula issue, which felt like it like really let us sit in the moment, this feels like it's making a lot of forward progress, which I really appreciated, with fantastic art.
Totally agree. Green Arrow number 11 from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Sean Isaacs, Phil Hester, and Eric Gapster. This is bringing together a lot of threads throughout Joshua Williamson's run, as Merlin, the evil archer, is revealed to be the mastermind behind everything that happens in Green Arrow. As a person who still is like, arrows? Really? Is that what we're doing? I like this issue, and I think like they are selling Merlin versus Green Arrow very well here. You don't buy it, Justin. What's
going on? You're just big upping Bullseye 2 minutes ago, and you're like, I'm out on arrows?
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Yes.
At least arrows, you have a propulsion with the bow that you're shooting at someone.
It makes more sense. Here's the thing. Bullseye can use anything. He can use, as you mentioned, peanuts, right?
That's right. Yeah,
all the arrow characters are like, I have a limited supply of arrows, but really an unlimited supply of arrows.
Let me just recap. You're saying a regular person, if you could take the best pitcher in baseball and he throws a peanut at you, you're telling me he's going to kill you? And the way that, that's what you think
is
of Bullseye?
Is that Bullseye?
Throw any harder. He has no superpowers. He doesn't throw harder. He just has good aim. That's his only thing. Same thing Green Arrow has, but he uses a cool bow.
It kills you. It goes directly down your throat. You choke to death.
Yeah,
we all saw Daredevil, the hit movie by Evan.
Also, what if that person's allergic to peanuts? They're dead twice, bro.
Okay, great. So you're telling me that Bullseye's whole thing is like hitting allergies in the right spot? Fine. If that becomes part of the story, I'm scared of him. But what I'm telling you is this issue
hits me with cat hair, I am fucked.
You're a fuck, dude. Yeah.
He's just snapping cat hair. You gotcha,
oh,
Alex. You're dead.
Oh God. Oh, it's making my nose itch.
Oh man. I think this is a great issue. I had a lot of fun with this. Love all the action. Love the villain backstory we get. This is just such great art. Cool last panel setting up the next issue. I just think that, you know, we've seen this premise before of like, you got to fight your friends. Oh, I don't want to fight my friends, but I'm still excited about what's to come.
I really enjoy this. I feel like this is one of the few books out there that combines a bunch of different artists in a way that really, really works. Mm-hmm. And that's fantastic. I really like Joshua Williamson's way that he's like slowly exploring, like dipping into Green Arrow history while at the same time propelling the story forward. I've been really, this is one of the better Green Arrow stories in quite some time.
Here are two books that I want to talk about together, and I want to talk about them together because I read them in the wrong order and
They even tell you how to read them.
I started to, is what I'm saying. So, Rise of the Powers of X, number 4 from Marvel, written by Kieran Gillen, art by R.B. Silva, and X-Men Forever, number 2 from Marvel, written by Kieran Gillen, art by Luca Maresca. I started...
Bless you.
Excuse me. Thank you. To read
cat hair, you mentioned cat hair, and then
it made me allergic. I started reading X-Men Forever number 2, and they were like, read Rise of the Powers of X because that takes place simultaneously. I was like, all right, fine, I'll go back. So these two books are taking place at the same time. Rise of the Powers of X takes place in the White Hot Room as we follow those characters there. X-Men Forever takes place outside the White Hot Room as Professor Xavier basically seemingly betrays everybody for Orcus. This is so dense. Both of these books. Justin, I'm curious to hear you talk. Well, I want to hear Justin talk about it just because he brought it up on the show, and it seemed like you had something to say.
I definitely do. I really like where... I like, of these two books, X-Men Forever feels... That's the juice. That's the forward motion here. Like there's several great moments in this, leading up to some great Jean Grey stuff. We get some sinister stuff here that is pretty fun. The thing that's frustrating to me, and especially we're in a mode where we're resetting the X-Men continuity, and this is not fair to bring it in, but we're watching X-Men 97 at the same time, where Professor X is legitimately hateable.
Yeah,
he's like the worst in this.
Yeah,
and definitely. Like I don't know why we're doing that. And like it feels like a choice. Maybe it's something that we're laying low our sort of mentor for the point of like saving him at the end, or he's gonna rise up at the end. But to have him being evil at the same time, everyone's like, yeah, fuck him. He lies all the time. I was like, everyone's just talking shit or Professor X is being a dick the whole time in these comics. I'm like, why is this the central focus of this event?
Can I throw a theory out at you? I think what we're seeing here is Professor X is actually going to save everybody because he has plans within plans within plans. But it's not going to matter. This is based on stuff that we've already seen. There's something happening with like a Prisoner X, which is somebody in like a Magneto helmet imprisoned in Cerebro. The popular theory is that's Professor X. So I think what's going to happen is like he actually kills a lot of people, destroys a lot of things, but ultimately saves the world, saves the X-Men, leads us to the new status quo, still has that heroic quality to him, but outwardly he is a war criminal who murdered a lot of people, and they're going to imprison him because of it. So that's what we're getting set up here, but I agree with you at the same time that it's like, this is too far. Professor X would never do these things, ever.
Pete? So you're saying that this asshole is somebody else, maybe. Okay, well, that's interesting. All right, so first off, badass cover on the Rise of Power of X. Just like really kind of epic. I want to focus on the positives first here. Just some really epic panels, amazing art, just beautiful splash pages. That whole kind of spring montage was fantastic. But I don't like this because, first off, it sounds like a math problem, the Rise of Power of X, and I don't want to do math when I'm reading comics. You know what I mean? I got enough. And that's also a little bit what's upsetting about this. There's so much things that I need to know about X-Men and pay attention to characters that I don't like or care about in ways that just drive me nuts. And, yeah, Charles has been a complete douche this whole time, and they're talking about it. And then you have fucking Nimrod, who just says splash, splash, or splish, splash, sploosh, or whatever he says. I mean, you might as well just have him go drip, water, splash at this point and make him a fucking meme, because it's ridiculous how much of a joke he is. And the fact that they're still fucking using this piece of shit is driving me insane.
And Marvel, just so you know, you can use "I don't want to do math" as a promotional quote for your book. No problem. No problem there.
Can we get into X-Men Forever now or what?
Yeah, we're talking about both.
We're covering both of them.
Okay, great, cool. All right, so let me see if I got this understandable. Okay, so somebody melts, and then Sinister is born, and then Jean gets set on fire, and then Hope's whole plan is that she's going to use a gun to shoot the Phoenix Force?
Yeah, she's going to double kill her.
I will say that.
How is this real and happening and not a fucking fever dream?
The gun thing at the end I thought was funny because it was like very not on the level of like Jean Grey coming back to life as Phoenix is reanimated. She's like, I'm the Punisher, sort of. I was like, okay.
What? Sure.
This is all very heady, is the problem that's going on here.
Yes. And we're in the middle. We're in the middle.
We're in the middle. There's more to come. I don't know. Even for somebody who's generally been enjoying this, this feels like a little too much is going on here, and it's a little too deep. But
really?
Yeah. But I don't know. At the same time, good art. There you go.
That's much more negative than normal. I actually liked a lot of the moments in this, especially in X-Men Forever.
What are you talking about?
And I feel like we are getting to the sort of finale rack situation.
No, I want to know what you enjoyed. Was it the melting lady? Did you enjoy that?
I loved the melting lady in the beginning.
I thought
that was
Mother
really cool.
Mother Righteous. She melts.
Mother Righteous as she's... And I love the setup in the other issue, which is like, I just melted out my... In Rise of Powers of X, she's like, I melted out my doppelganger in the white room, and then we got to see it, which I thought was really cool and established her as sort of like good. And I love the build up between Hope, Rachel, and Jean Grey of Phoenix, like three characters that are in that realm. There's some cool stuff happening.
I will say I did really like the tease of Hope being like, I still don't know who my parents are. And I was like, that feels like something we're going to established pretty soon, potentially.
It just was so jarring to be like, okay, you know, like Rise of the Phoenix, and all of a sudden somebody's pulling out a gun, and it's just like, what this?
If you saw Firebird,
you hate
that. You shoot
no, him? I just think that there are comics that have guns and it makes sense in the world, but all of a sudden, if Batman is like, yo, I got two Glocks, I don't roll with batarangs anymore, I'd be like, what?
You know who the next Phoenix is?
Story.
The next Phoenix is the Punisher. The Phoenix Force is going to grab the Punisher up.
Well, then, you know, then after that happens, it would make sense to have guns in an X-Men comic. But
why don't we move on and talk about Drawing Blood, number one from Image Comics, written by Kevin Eastman and David Avalon, art by Ben Bishop. This is about a comic book artist who created a property back in the day that was ridiculously popular. He broke up with his partner, lost a bunch of his money, and now he's embroiled in a crime situation. Other than the crime situation, this is basically Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, but it spins off in very different directions from there. I'm not the biggest fan of gossip, but I was very much looking forward to this as like, what is he going to say that's very realistic about his relationship with Peter Laird? And reading this book, I was like, nothing. Literally nothing.
No hot
comics.
Topics.
If you're going to comics for hot gossip, you're not going to get it.
Well, I don't know. I think that's a very, I use this term on the live show, but like the robot a clef, the thing where you're like, I'm going to lightly fictionalize this thing about my real life. But this is very much, as far as I can tell, heavily fictionalized, other than I'm a guy who created a thing about some animals who do ninja stuff and then I lost all the money. Like that's where the true part comes in, but then the rest of it is... I don't know, whatever it is.
I demand the Laird response. When do we get the Laird take?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is going to be like, you know, fun when rappers used to have beef, you know, and then we had diss tracks. You know what I mean? We're going to get diss comics. This is going to be fun. First off, the Eastman art, the flashback, hit me in such a glorious mm-hmm. wave of nostalgia for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and the way artistically they used grayscale and used shading and did such like really kind of cool things with just one color. Oh God, I loved it.
Can I just interrupt to say what you're talking about is there's a sequence where the two creators of this comic back in the day at a Comic-Con get some advice from an older creator. That's the part that felt true to me. That felt like this probably happened to the two of them at some point, and you're putting this in the comic. The rest of it, not so much.
I agree. And it feels like it's having some fun here. But I don't think this is the expose that you're talking about, and I don't think it ever will be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think this is enjoyable and interesting, though. I mean, you know, there's success stories, there's heartbreaking stories, and we're kind of getting a little bit of kind of both in this. So I'm interested to see where this is going to go and what's going to happen.
Let's talk about a real expose about the monsters that live among us right now. Something is Killing the Children, number 36, from Boom Studios, written by James Tynion IV, art by Werther Deldaria. After the climactic huge events of the last couple of issues, we're jumping back in time to follow another adventure with Erica, our main character. What'd you guys think about this one?
Yeah, it was nice to roll with Erica again. I mean, this was just a fun kind of like her being adorable and talking about, you know, how important pets are. And like sometimes these monsters are eating kids and sometimes they're going for your pets, you know. So this was a fun kind of like sweet, touching, adorable kind of story in the middle of all this madness. I thought it was a cool break. And great to kind of see Erica again.
When do we get the Something is Killing the Puppies spinoff?
Oh,
is this it? Because we're here. I thought this was great. One of my, favorite issues from this title in a while. And it's kicking off what seems like maybe a series of standalone issues with Road Stories Part 1.
I would like it better if it was a one-shot, if it was a Times Past type thing.
From Starman.
Shout out Starman. To give us like a little break after the awful things that happened in the past couple of issues.
This is a little break.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. It feels like, per what Justin is saying, we're going to get more of these one-shot back-of-the-day things. It's fine. I like this book. But I want to get back to the main action because things were so bad for Erica and so big in the last issue that I want to see what happens next. So
she's a road dog. It makes sense that we get a little bit of break up here.
I mean, the road dog for sure. But I do want to just kind of stop and take a moment and talk about the amazing art in this book. It is just consistently phenomenal and just super tight nanners. And I love it so much.
Nanners. Do you feel like you wish your eyes took up like 30% of your
face? Yes, dude. Come on, man. Who doesn't want giant eyes, bro?
From Road Dogs to Cats on the Road, let's talk about Feral number 2 from Image Comics, written by Tony Fleeks, art by Trish Forstner and Tone Rodriguez. This is basically Walking Dead, but with cats, as we get a bunch of felines who are trying to escape from rabies-infested creatures in the woods. Things got real bad in this issue. Like, last issue was really just an overture for what happens here. It's bloody, it's gross, it's tense. Really like this book.
I agree. Like, and I love the way that they're literally finding that, able to vacillate between those two tones of the, like, sort of bright Disney-esque cat characters and the true Walking Dead reality that they're in. Like, that's something that we talked about a lot on the last comic from these guys. So, like, to have that here again, and it still feels new and interesting, amazing. They were able to pull this off.
Yeah, I mean, they do kind of, like, we actually get to see humans in this issue towards the end there, and that really kind of amps up.
You love humans.
Well, not all the time, but I just think that
just real quick, would you rather have a cat as a pet or a human as a pet?
Cat. Human would be
Love a human. Oh, definitely a human.
Yeah,
I think
have a human be like, go to the bathroom in that little box, you human. You disgusting little human.
All right, let's
try. I would love it if a human would, like, curl up and lay down.
If I could just talk about this comic before you guys got weird, just to get this out, you know what I mean?
Sorry, if you rub the human just right, he purrs. He just purrs.
You got to rub him under the chin.
This is an insane issue. I mean, just kind of breakneck speed here. And the ending, just holy shit. I was very shocked. But yeah, I love the tension and the action in this. They're doing such a great job with the pacing of this. It's kind of an insane spinoff of Stray, which I didn't think I would like so much, but I am having a good time with this.
Superior Spider-Man number 6 from Marvel, written by Dan Slott and Christos Gage, art by Mark Bagley. In this issue, oh my God, everybody's sneezing. Dr. Octopus. If we could just,
real quick, like, if you're going to chew ice, go on mute. If you got to sneeze or something, go on fucking mute.
Chew ice? I tried to mute, but I hit the wrong button.
Okay.
Was that me? I chewed ice?
Yeah, you were chewing ice, man. Just sitting there gnawing on.
Sorry. I love it.
That's great, but
I love it. I love comics and I love
chewing ice. He's giving birth. He's giving birth right now. He's
if Justin's talking and you're gnawing on ice, like, what the fuck are people supposed to be listening to?
I don't know, man. I honestly don't know. Superior Spider-Man. Doc Ock and Spider-Man are fighting in this issue over a Electric Lady and Adam Marcone. And that's pretty much what's going on.
And then Spider-Boy.
Yeah, and Spider-Boy is dropping spiders in people's noses.
I feel like Dan Slott has created a slot-verse. Yeah. I feel like there's a tiny microverse that Dan Slott has created in Inside Marvel that is his, it's his tone, it's his, everything is happening in his little area. And that is amazing. It's so hard to do that. The fact that he's done it successfully is amazing. And Superior.
Pete?
Yeah, I said the thing about Spider.
Don't like this on principle. I had a fun time with this book.
Why don't you like this, Pete?
He just doesn't like the Superior Spider-Man.
Yeah, if you put the Superior title on something, you lose me. I don't.
But I'm not into it. Everyone's being themselves in this, essentially.
Yeah,
essentially.
It's a good Doc Ock book. It's a good Spider-Man book. It's fun. It's a fun time.
I agree. It's fun. And it's just like Dan Slott found his voice. And he has been able to execute it for, like, it's impossible to be able to have your voice exist on its own within one of the big two for this many years. And Dan Slott has done it successfully while still introducing a character like Spider-Boy that is hugely
popular. He's going hard right now in Spider-Boy. You know what I mean? I feel like less is more sometimes. But I agree with you. I think Dan Slott's a hilarious, amazing writer.
The Flash, number 8 from DC Comics, written by Cy Spurrier, art by Ramon Perez and Vasco Georgiev. In this issue, Wally West is missing, so Barry Allen is trying to pick up the slack, doing a good job at it, I guess, except not for his psyche. This title leads into horror. It leads into psychology. I continue to absolutely love what they're doing here, particularly as they're just breaking Barry Allen down over the course of the issue. Good stuff.
Yeah, I really think the use of the art here to show the kind of Flash running around is really impressive. Crazy last panel, and Waller hates podcasts. So,
yeah, well, but also she guests on them. So let's try to get Mandy to join our podcast.
I would love that. Amanda Waller on our podcast, that would be a get.
Dude, I don't think you can call her Mandy, bro.
That's what she introduces herself in this issue. I feel like we're going to get a lot of Amanda Waller saying her philosophy over the course of the next year in DC Comics. This is one of the best versions of it. So if you're interested in larger DC continuity, I would pick this issue up just to read what the way they sort of approach Amanda Waller's take here. Really well done. And I think the way this comic is embracing the flaws of the Speedsters is amazing. You never see it. It's become one of my favorite reads right now. It really is like showing these characters not doing a great job, abdicating their duties, trying hard and failing, and showing the Speed Force to be like sort of a bummer. So like having to rely, it's like being like, hey, it's like our Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, my Wi-Fi sucks right now. And you're like, well, sucks to be you. That's what the Speed Force is for.
Duke, number 5 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Tom Riley. This is the final issue of this title as as our future G.I. Joe character clashes with a bunch of Cobra characters, I think, and is suspicious of Transformer characters. Pete!
Oh, man, yeah.
What'd you think?
I thought it was awesome. I mean, Duke versus a bat? I mean, that's fucking fun, man. The only weird part for me was Destro being a white guy. You know, in the cartoon and stuff. In the cartoon
he was talking about, he's wearing a silver mask all over his face.
Yeah, but you can see his hands and
I don't see hands.
Oh, okay, cool. Rob Liefeld loves you then. I just think it's one of those things where this is just fun. Great kind of use of the G.I. Joe characters, and then kind of this fun twist of, like, at first it seems like he's against Optimus Prime, but I'm sure once they fight but then have a chat.
He hates Truck Daddy.
Well, at first, but then he's going to learn to love Truck Daddy like the rest of us do.
Mm-mm. He's going to – he hates
it's fucking Optimus Prime, bro. You know what I mean? Like, but, yeah, amazing art. Love all the action. I was really worried that they killed off Duke for a second there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But he is alive, but Deathstroke is here, and he's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Destro is always a problem.
Oh, Destro. That's what we're saying.
Yeah, not Destro.
Slightly different.
And Destro, different. The guy in the silver mask, is different from Cobra Commander, who is also in a silver mask.
Yeah, but that different silver mask. I mean, one, there's no face search, and then the other is has facial features. You know,
well, and let's remember, like, the biggest difference in G.I. Joe is that one, they both have silver masks, but one has a sick necklace and the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the biggest. Yeah, a lot like, let me, I have a father of daughters. I have a lot of Barbies. A lot of the Barbies stuff is like, oh, this one has a necklace and this one doesn't. And so that's just like these characters.
Cool.
Right? Yeah. Right,
Pete? That's usually how you hear that phrase. Right? As a father of daughters, that Barbie has a necklace and that one doesn't.
Yeah. And I know the difference between Deathstro, I mean, and the other guy.
Yeah, I don't want to brag, but I have daughters, and I know who Destro is. Anyway, The Avengers number 13 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Francesco Martorino. This is following the current storyline going on in X-Men as Orcus is being attacked. What?
Following the current storyline, end of statement.
This issue has several pages in it, and by the end, it tees up the next issue, which will be coming out next month.
Another successful review.
I'm Bert Hapley, and there you go. Anyway, we are fighting Orcus here in the cliffhanger of the last issue. They had sent a ton of Sentinels to attack them at the direction of the 3D man who was jilted by the Avengers. Or was he? Great twists and turns in this issue, I honestly thought. Versus the last issue where I was surprised how frequently the Avengers were winning. This issue, I thought it all really paid off with some great plot points, some great reveals. Really dug this quite a bit.
Yeah, me too.
Agree.
Oh, go ahead.
You go.
I felt like this was a great Avengers issue. You know, it had a lot of the classic Avengers stuff. There's some fun twists and turns, but amazing action, some cool hero moments. Yeah, I just felt like the sleeper Avenger was a fun kind of idea. It just felt like a good Avenger book, you know?
Especially for an issue that is sort of biting onto X-Men continuity, I thought this really was one of the more effective all-Avengers working together issues that we've seen in a while. Great use of continuity with Yuna and Miss Marvel, I thought was awesome. So effectively done.
Yeah.
I was fooled by 3D Man when he's revealed as the villain in this issue. I was like, he's a good guy. what's happening here? And I was sort of like mad about it. And then when it was revealed that that was the point, I was like, oh, you got me. You got me so hard, Ben McKay. Shout out to you. I thought it was great top to bottom. I'm really enjoying Jed McKay bit off a lot with the Ashen Combine. And yes, I know both of those words, the Impossible City, all the big sort of choices. But as a status quo, I really appreciate where we are. I hope this stays going for a long time.
Once Upon a Time at the End of the World, number 14 from Boom Studios, written by Jason Aaron, art by Nick Dragota, Alexandra Defengi, and Leila Del Duca. This is a huge issue as Mezco and, I don't know, two characters.
Oh, my God, dude.
Jesus. I love this book. That's the embarrassing part. Anyway, our two characters who are very old are battling their way through to save the world. And over the course of this issue, they flash back to various eras to really just reevaluate their relationship over the years. Really got me in the feels with this one. Very well done issue.
Justin, you go ahead. I mean, you're the true head stand for this.
This is your your picks. But I will say, like, the Mezzi and Masio, like, the way they've been able to...
You know their names. Okay.
Yeah, that's a flex. But the way that... The way that they've taken the metaphor of relationship and that Jason Aaron has taken us away from that and brought us into a post-apocalyptic world, ton of specifics about that, but then keeps bringing us back to, like, this is all about how relationships work and the way the pitfalls. There's just a great sequence of sort of talking head panels where Masio and Mezzi are talking about the moment in their relationship where they sort of lost the faith. I thought was so intimate, beautiful. This just comic from top to bottom. If you haven't picked up any issues, start at the beginning, get the trades, and read this through. It's just such a great meditation on how we are with each other, the people that are important to us. And it's beautifully done, but still giving us some great genre comic book stuff at the same time. Huge pickup.
JT says, I can't agree with you more. You know, as the real Aaron head, though, I just think that this is such
couple questions.
I'll pause my review to answer questions. Yes,
no, I just say, as the real Aaron shirt? Head?
Yeah,
as the real Aaron head?
Yeah, I'm the true Aaron head in this group.
Okay, we got to talk about that. We're going to have a draft where we who we are the heads of.
All right, fine. I got no problem with that. But I just think that showing such an epic relationship, but then talking about how fragile humans are and how fragile relationships are and how just little moments mean so much, you know, like just one time looking a certain way at somebody, you know what I mean, what that means, or not saying goodnight, which seems like such a stupid thing, but means the world to another person, you know, like truly knowing somebody. And I just think that this is, I mean, the fact that you saw how hard they were fighting and it was almost like they were fighting for each other, but then when the fighting stopped, how awkward they were, just so every chance they could have done something sappy and dumb and they took a smarter choice and made a smarter decision about the writing and just showcasing. And not to take anything away from the art, because the art is so fantastic in this book and epic on many levels. The amount of different characters and different facial stuff, it's a lot to be able to do and to convey in this, because there are so many layers and so many levels. So this is a really impressive comic and a blast and worth checking out for sure. It's going to get you in the goddamn feels.
The next issue is the last issue, and I am so nervous and curious to find out what their final statement about relationships is.
Can't wait.
There.
I almost thought this was the last issue reading.
Yeah.
The Infernals, number 3 from Image Comics, written by Noah Gardner and Ryan Parrott, art by John J. Pearson and Lola Bonato. We are following the kids of a guy who is fated to demonically destroy the world, bring about the apocalypse, and just kind of didn't.
Sometimes you don't live up to your expectation. Now, Alex, Ryan Parrott's your guy.
Yeah. Zalbin.
Yeah, you're a parrot head.
Yeah, you're a parrot head.
Polly want a cracker, if you ask me.
Oh, boy.
I like this book. I like the fact that he's following one sibling per issue, because we got a little bit of a like King Lear thing going on here with the three kids of the prospective heir who are trying to vie for the throne. We described it as like succession goes to hell, I think, when we were talking
about that's good.
Issue, and that's still very much valid here. There's some great twists and turns, I thought, in terms of the premise, but I really like the focus on not our main character, but our dad character here, as he deals with his current wife and his ex-wife. I thought there was some really good character stuff happening in this issue.
Love the art. Love the focus on just a goat walking around.
Yeah, I think this is just such a creepy, great time. I mean, I love the art style with the black kind of like letterbox, the dark tones, the glowing eyes, just a really impressive attention to detail. Love the letters page, like the depiction of heaven. This is very exciting. I think they're taking some big swings, making some interesting choices. I'm excited to see what happens.
Predator, The Last Hunt, number 3 from Marvel, written by Ed Bryson, art by Eder Macias. In this issue, our main characters are being attacked by a super predator and obliterated. That's pretty much the whole issue, just absolutely ripped in half, hole shot in the intestines hanging out. There's cursing. It's for adults. It's like
You love that cursing, right, Alex?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, apparently just not in Deadpool, you fucking douchebag. Yeah, I think this is a great kind of like raise escalation of terror here. They kind of fall into a trap. Tons of kind of giant battles. We get monsters as well as predators here. There's a lot going on, but it's a very cool kind of package that we're getting with art and storytelling that I think is delivering on a nice level.
Shouts to this comic for, like, they really set us up to be like, these characters have got it. They're not scared of the predators. They're going to crush them. And this issue was the turnabout. It upsets the normal predator sort of logic is these things are scary, and it's a long buildup of them being undefeatable, and then they lose. This, it was the flip. It was like, these things are defeatable. And then in this issue, we get like just straight up murder. Shouts to that. Looking forward to the last issue coming next month.
Ooh. Yeah, really anything could happen. The Penguin, number 9 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Rafael De La Torre. The Penguin is finally back to Gotham City. And he is saying that he is not trying to take back the crime world of Gotham, but of course he is. And his lieutenants are going out and doing it. Batman can't quite get it together
to figure out
the mystery, but knows that something is wrong at the same time. And that's the inherent tension of this issue. Another great issue of this title.
I thought the vibe of this issue was so funny, where it was like, we all know that the Penguin's doing this shit, and then it's all Batman being like, who's doing this?
Yeah.
Batman, I gotta crack this case.
And that's the thing, is that the entire time Batman's like, it's definitely the Penguin. The Penguin is doing it, but I'm a detective, but I can't prove it. And every clue points elsewhere, and it's driving me insane.
Yeah, because
it's funny. Sorry, Pete. It's funny that Tom King creates that tension between us and Batman, which is such a funny place to read a comic from, where we're like, Batman, we know it's this. And Batman's like, I know it's this. And I'm like, yes, I agree with you, Batman. And he's like, but I can't crack it. I'm like, Batman.
Batman repeating the words, he's always thought I was a fool, was just like, oh my God. Like, it also has this weird thing of like, Batman, are you doubting yourself right now? Because it seems like, you know, which is something that you don't see a lot of in Batman comics, is him kind of like being frustrated and also kind of doubting himself. I mean, the fact that he kind of is kind of repeating that was almost kind of scary to me. But man, I was like, ready to say this is my favorite issue of this, but that last panel, Penguin kind of kneeling there being like, I'm a bad boy, was so weird and dumb that, like, I was like, fuck this issue.
Okay, let's talk about
this. Fuck this fucking issue.
This entire series for 9 issues so far has been about building up the Penguin to explain why he is actually a good adversary for Batman and not just a guy who uses umbrellas and goes, walk, walk, walk. This is the issue
this
that shows
us. This is the first
us.
Issue that he does go, walk, 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 though.
I think
ironically.
Different. Yes. This shows us his weakness, and his weakness is seemingly the one woman he has ever been honest with and actually ever loved. We don't know a lot about her. We know she is the mother of the twins, I want to say, who are currently ruling the Gotham underworld. But that's it, and presumably there's going to be more at the next issue as we continue to truck through that. I thought that was great. I love that moment.
Hard
to agree. I think this comic is fantastic. The way it's playing with our narrative point of view is really rare. We switch narrators, like, I want to say 5 times in this issue from just different characters, and it works. Tom King is just a pro.
Also, the art's phenomenal.
The Forged, number 7 from Image Comics, written by Greg Rucka and Eric Troutman, art by Mike Henderson. We are following a bunch of very beefy ladies as they fight a interstellar threat.
What are you doing right now?
I mean, they're like, they're pretty jacked. They're big. They're bigger than me.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm not saying that derogatorily. I'm very impressed. I can't get that big.
Okay.
Yeah, they're huge.
I mean, you could with some time and effort and dedicated your
life
really
to it. That's really nice, Pete. That's really nice.
Thank you so much.
Lay off the Ozempic, Alex, and get jacked.
Yeah, come on, man.
No, never.
Start drinking some fucking creatine shakes. You know what I mean? Like, let's fucking do it. Get some
swole, guy.
Yeah, like,
let's do it. You know what we should do over the course of the year? We should do a comic book club. Get swole challenge. What do you
guys
think?
Yes. Dude, let's go to the end of the year. We'll just be like, nothing but muscle, unable to move our bodies or our necks.
You'd be like,
hit us up at hashtag CBSwole, and we will get out there and start beefing it up.
Let's beef it up.
These 3 beefcakes are going hard.
Well, I think that covered everything you need to know about the Forged. And
I thought this was fun. I love the Gundam mech kind of style action scenes. Great arc, very kind of sleek and stylish. This is a great package. You know, maybe the glowing bikini scene was a little, but it's still fine.
I think this is great. I love Greg Rucka. I love the way he doesn't put out a ton of comics on a year-by-year basis, but what he does feels like he loves and he goes hard every moment. I think this is fantastic.
The Amazing Spider-Man number 48 from Marvel, written by Zeb Wells, art by Todd Knock. In this issue, Chasm and Hallow's Eve had teamed up with the Goblin Queen to try to get Chasm his memories back, except actually maybe turn him into a goblin.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of revelations there as Spider-Man very half-heartedly tries to stop Chasm from doing this while he's helping out Betty Brant to get back a machine that turned Ned Leeds into a hobgoblin. I ran out of steam there just because this issue is very much like, there's a lot of continuity, and I understand all of this continuity, but at the same time, we are once again getting what has been my main frustration with the Spider-Man run. We're losing track of Spider-Man in the midst of everything else that's happening.
Yeah, but I don't know. I felt like this is a loose track of. I thought this was a good issue to do it. I like this issue. I had fun with it. I thought also fun cover.
Wow.
I thought that I liked the ending. I feel like they did an interesting job of, like, you know, we kind of just had this Halloween kind of issue that kept going with this kind of interesting character who would put on these different masks. And to have them kind of find love in this way of, like, hey, Ben, you're enough, bro. We don't need to do this. I thought was a nice kind of place to land for them.
I mean, I guess I'm somewhere in between you two. Like, I feel like this issue, Spider-Man saying over and over again, this is important. And everyone else is like, is it? Like, Ben's like, I'm just here to do stuff. Hallows Eve is like, I think I'm trying to help him out. Like, everyone's just sort of doing their own thing. I almost wanted, because I feel like I know where what's happening with Spider-Man in the future with some goblin stuff. I thought Spider-Man was going to get tossed into this machine. And that was maybe going to become important, but it felt like it was just a lot of stuff in the world. I love Hallows Eve. I think Ben as a character, the chasm stuff could be cool. It just feels like they keep smashing in Spider-Man into them, and it's just not quite working with what we what this means.
You know? I love the kind of chaos though that Hallows Eve caused of like.
Agreed.
You know, the, like,
she turns into just Vlad.
That was awesome. Yeah, and Hackslash, because it was like this really insane moment of like, okay, we're going to strap you in, and I'm just going to put on a mask and kind of like take care of them. And I was like, wait, what's going on? And she just kind of casually slips on and then just turns into this giant, unstoppable monster. And I was just like, oh my God, what a kind of fun use of her power and just kind of a great kind of thing. Yeah, I just thought it was some cool choices being made here.
Man's Best, number two for Boob Studios, written by Pornsack Pinchot and art by Jesse Lonergan. In this issue, our three cyborg pets are battling a bunch of clangers, which are
robots,
machines, etc. Pete, you love this book. Why don't you take it away?
First off, crazy cool cover. What an ish, man. I just amazeballs art. Just really phenomenal next level art. I love the kind of tech on these dogs and cats and some really touching moments, but that ending, oh shit. I didn't think that was going to happen. I was very surprised and shocked. I cannot wait for the next issue because I'm hoping maybe a character that is great is not dead, but who knows? Man, great issue.
I also love this issue. Like I feel like this is at the this issue is going to get a lot of like comparison to We Three, but it's actually quite different. It pushes that idea into a lot of different, more fantastical directions, and it is fun.
World Tree, number 9 from Image Comics, written by James Tynion IV. Once again, art by Fernando Blanco.
JT4 Block.
In this issue, we're mostly jumping back in the day to see a little bit of the genesis of this team that came against the Undernet, the evil internet that lives below ours. Meanwhile, in the present timeline, we're getting our nude lady is attacking the lady with the eye patch and trying to turn her. We get the revelation that the reason she's nude is that her tattoos are a ghost circuit that can activate the internet, which honestly, I wish I had around here. My internet goes down a lot, and if I had a nude lady with a tattoo circuit who could activate ghosts to give me back the internet, that would be great.
Well, you could just get some tattoos. You know what I mean? That could help your
Wi-Fi connection. I'm not a nude lady. If I can pay, I don't know if Spectrum is listening here, but Spectrum, I will pay for that service. Yeah, if there could be a nude lady in my basement attached to the internet at all times, that would be really helpful.
It's getting weird as a request. Yeah. Getting weird as a request.
Should I keep talking about it?
Yeah. Nah. I mean,
further?
This, I wish you wouldn't. I wish you would stop. Yeah, I mean, this doesn't pass the train test. You can't read this in public. But just a heads up, if you see someone who's naked, covered in blood, just run. Run for your life, especially if they start glowing. This comic makes me really worried about the internet. It's probably going to murder us all is what this comic is saying. And I'm now scared.
Real quick. What do you think the sexiest router you've ever seen is? I'm going to say Linksys. What about you guys?
Oh, sick. Yes, of course. Took the answer right out of my mouth. I feel like this is the most David Lynchian comic on the stands. Ooh. And this issue proves it. If you're a fan of that, definitely pick this up. Love this.
Gods, number 7 from Marvel, written by Jonathan Hickman, Gods! Art by Valerio Schiti. This is the second to last issue of this title, and of course, It's all really starting to build to a head here as one of our characters, who I definitely remember the name of, travels to a alternate dimension to rescue his parents. I'm being a little facetious here, but I will say there is a fair amount of emotion in this issue as we follow the envoy to the powers that be. I may have gotten that wrong. As he tries to rescue his parents from this other dimension in a unauthorized mission type scenario. It's pretty sad. This is coupled with the last issue where we watched one of our characters lose her eyes trying to save somebody else. There's something here in this title. We're just not quite there yet. Like, this is, we're seven issues in, and I still feel like we're building emotional connections to these characters, but it's about to end the next issue, at least for the foreseeable future. And I don't quite care about everybody personally.
Interesting. I agree. It's like a real twist around this comic, but I like this as a standalone issue. I like the story that was told here. And I like the way that this comic is sort of like carving out a hole in the Marvel universe and being like, Doctor Strange is here, so it's cool, right? He's like a token to make this part of the Marvel universe when it's really just like some standalone fun Jonathan Hickman stuff.
Yeah, I just feel that like you know, holy sheedy, this art is just phenomenal. I mean, just kind of like some real epic, outstanding panels here. So I have no idea what the fuck's happening at all. You know, it seems like Dr. Strange is trying to help. That's about all I got. But I can't say enough about the outstanding art.
All right. The Bloody Dozen, A Tale of the Shrouded College, number 5 from Image Comics, written by Charles Soule, art by Alberto Jimenez Albuquerque. This is the penultimate issue of this title. It's a bunch of vampires attack in space. That's basically what's going on here. I ran out of steam a little bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah. I can tell because you keep saying that.
Yes. Great book. Good action. Good emotion here. It definitely seems like they're really going for it in terms of letting these characters literally roast in the sun if they have to. I appreciate that. I appreciate just kind of like not being like, we got to save this character for later on in another series. Well, just be like, let's see where it goes.
Let's go.
Called The Bloody Dozen, like lean into it. You know what
let's
I mean?
Get bloody. Well, great family stuff. And also the way that this comic has progressed from the first issue where it was about a couple astronauts. And now we're so far from that premise. Like this comic is moving and that's exciting.
Yeah, I agree. First off, the art by the Kirky is just phenomenal. I also really love the kind of fun ending montage where it's like somebody's mind getting blown and you kind of get this life montage. Very cool, artistically interesting way to kind of showcase that. You know, somebody's life flashing before their eyes, but man, these vampires are fucking shit up, bro. It's a real issue. I think we ought to really try to look into this vampire problem.
I just want to give a quick shout out. I think I forgot to send this to you guys, but the Ministry of Compliance, number 5 from IDW, written by John Ridley, art by Stefano Raphael. We had John Ridley on a couple of months back to talk about this book. And what? Pete?
He said, yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did.
He's never said that. Pete?
No, he said, are you?
I know, he agreed with me. Usually he's like,
we should talk about the comic.
Yeah, usually he's like, we should have them on to talk about it. After I say that, I'm very thrown right now.
It's fun to
mess with you when you're out of gas.
I'm absolutely stunned.
The opposite of the bit.
Oh my God. This is the end of the first arc of the book about an alien invasion of Earth, and it ends in a absolutely epic way. Definitely pick up this book. I assume it's going to be collected in trade at some point. Action is great. Twists are great. I love everything that's going on here. There's some
I agree with you. We should have him on here to talk about this. Too bad we never have.
There it is.
But I also just think that, like, the story on this slaps. The art is just unbelievable. I love something that... Yeah, it's just something that just goes hard and pulls you right in along on this train ride. And, man, I loved every panel. You know what I mean? Just really... Oh, that's right. I didn't read this one. But... it's great.
Anyway, I did read this one. I thought it was very good. I really liked how it wrapped up here and kicked us into the next stage with this story. I'll try to get you guys a copy so you can check it out.
Oh, cool. That'd be nice. And that way I'll revisit the interview we did with them. You know what I mean? Yeah,
there we go. We should really have him on to talk about this book. I would say Rare Flavors, number 5 from Boom Studios, written by Rom V, art by Felipe Andrade. We've been saying it wrong for years, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
In any case, this is, I think, the second to last issue of this, as well as we've been following a documentarian who is tagging along with a demon who just loves to eat people. Wants to eat people. Is that so wrong? You know,
Soylent Green is made of people.
It's not a big deal.
I love this comic. And let me say, like, every issue is very good. I love the way we sort of get the pivot here on what the fight is. But honestly, at the end of the day, I feel like if this guy just didn't eat people, everything would be fine. He doesn't seem to want to eat people.
You can say that a lot, if you would just take out the horrible thing about them. Yeah, exactly.
But we never really see him eat a ton of people in this comic. So the comic isn't about him. This comic is about the sins of the past coming back to haunt you when you're trying to move on.
Yeah, but we're told he ate a person a week ago.
Yeah, a week ago.
Yeah. But also,
but you didn't see it, so it's not
in the past. You didn't see it. You didn't see him.
I forgive him. He seems cool. I like the reference to also Anthony Bourdain.
This guy. By the way, you work professionally as a judge, right?
Yeah, I'm a cannibal judge. I'm cannibal or no cannibal.
Didn't see it. Case closed.
Coming this fall to Freevee, Cannibal Judge, starring me, Justin Tyler.
I would like to talk about how Rare Flavors is really impressive as an idea. Like, the fact that we kind of don't know that he's eating people, then we kind of get the reveal, and then somehow you end up kind of liking him a little bit just by the sweet note that he leaves.
I don't mind that he eats people at all.
Sweet delicious note. Okay.
It's funny how a sucker I am for just kind of honesty and sweet moments. But I just think that the art here, though, is just on such another level. I mean, the fact that we're getting these kind of amazing panels of color and spice and flavor, and then the art.
Everything nice.
And recipes. And there's a lot going on. And there's a guy who eats people, yet artistically, it's really impressive.
You mean me?
What?
Sorry.
Final issue to talk about, Six Fingers, number 3. We don't have time to talk about this. Six Fingers, number 3 from Image Comics, written by Dan Waters, art by Sumeet Kumar. This is part of a two-series, whatever you want to call it.
Jam session.
There you go, with Rom V. Between the Six Fingers and the One Hand, this is a vitally important issue that really reveals a ton of what's happening behind the scenes, almost literally, with most of these comic books. I want to talk about a spoiler in the second because I cannot believe we didn't pick up on it, but great art, great mystery, absolutely wild. Love this book.
Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. I just have to say that when we're talking about the six-figured man here. But yeah, I just think this comic rocks. It's really creepy and fucked up, but also it's very interesting and very creative, and it's worth it for the art alone.
Agreed. Love this experiment. Alex, are you about to get into it?
Yeah.
All I was going to say, and this is spoilers here for the book, but... the reveal here is that basically the concept is the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, which seems okay. I feel like I should have figured that out from the titles, but I absolutely didn't. And the reveal here is that the killer, we don't know everything yet, but the killer that we've been following in
he's
in the walls, but he is the left hand, and the detective we've been following over in the one hand is the right hand, and it's the right hand doesn't know what the left hand has been doing the entire time.
The duality of that and the pairing of these comics is such a smart little meta trick that, to your point, Alex, we should have seen coming, but is so well deployed here, right?
It's kind of insane, and it raises a lot of questions, but it's also very intriguing.
I'm looking at my hands in a whole new way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Gotta watch
the them. Right podcaster doesn't know what the left podcaster is.
Depending on how we turn out in this video, you'll have to determine it for yourself. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we're doing, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube.
We sure do.
Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live. On Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live. On TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Yeah, stay Dick Tracy out there.
What? I want to be that blows your mind.